In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate, thank you very much for coming here tonight in this rainy night. And I was just minutes away from missing my flight, actually, to Fresno. So it's just a blessing to be amongst good friends in Fresno tonight again. First of all, happy Easter to all my good Christian brothers and sisters in the audience. And also, Muslims are commemorating the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, so Eid Mubarak to all Muslim brothers and sisters in the audience. Tonight's lecture, as Dariush pointed out, the topic is embracing diversity and overcoming division. There is a lot of bad publicity about religion in general, in the media, and Islam in particular. A lot of people are arguing, especially in liberal press, that a case can be made against religion's high profile in societal affairs. Tonight, what I'm going to try to do is to make a case for religion. Religion is at its best when it unites humanity to pursue justice and compassion. Religion is at its worst when it divides humanity into warring camps to commit brutality in the name of God. Both possibilities exist. Both potentials do exist in all world religions. Tonight's lecture aims at pointing out the pitfalls in religiosity, ideas and practices that can make religious folks to become foot soldiers of evil. I will begin tonight with a brief introduction about the rising profile of religion in societal affairs and how this resurgence of religious fervor caught secularists and social scientists off guard practically in the 20th century. Then I will address this question: does religion make people bad, or is it bad folks who make religion look bad? Then I will dedicate most of the lecture to giving you an idea about three or four major pitfalls in religiosity. Tonight's lecture is theology neutral, so to speak. It does not specifically address any particular religion. It equally applies to all religious folks around the world. So in that regard, I hope that you will find the lecture at least intellectually thought-provoking and challenging. Let me begin with that introduction that I said I would do with regard to the resurgence of religion in modern times. Over the past few decades, we have been witnessing a new trend in many parts of the world. Religion is taking on a higher profile in social life of many nations. In the Islamic world, Muslims are demanding a greater role for their religion, Islam, in the management of society. In Iran, the Sudan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Egypt, and lately in the occupied Palestinian territories, Muslim political activists and organizations have been practically setting the tone and direction of public policy and political debate in that part of the world. One could perhaps dismiss the resurgence of religion in the Islamic world as an isolated case, and for example, argue that resurgence of religion is really limited to third world circumstances and social settings. However, I believe we can find the same trend in the most scientifically and technologically advanced nation in the world, the US. The same trend that exists, for example, in the Islamic world, we can find it here right in our homeland. As you probably know, most political observers believe that President George Bush won the White House primarily because of the backing of the Christian conservative movement. Christian conservatives in the U.S. do believe that Christianity, in particular religion in general, must have a bigger presence in formation of public policy and running and management of our society. They like to see religion having a greater impact in national policy making. For example, if you follow the press accounts, issues such as a ban on abortion, prayers in public school, ban on gay marriage, teaching creationism in public schools, these are all the hot button items for Christian conservatives. And they're hoping that by their voting power, they can inject these teachings and principles in public policy making. The religious right in the U.S. seems even to regard President George Bush as their national leader. This is an important and unprecedented phenomenon in U.S. history, I believe, that a religious community would view the person occupying the highest office of the land as their, quote-unquote, national leader. This is very interesting in a nation that prides itself in the separation of church and state. As you probably know, President George Bush had a lot of problems with his financing and some problem apparently with alcohol decades ago. He turned to Christianity for help. He considers himself a born-again Christian. So that is an idea that the president of this nation holds very dearly and seriously. As you know, President Bush frequently uses biblical concepts when articulating his international agenda. Time and again, he uses the phrase good versus evil. That is explicitly a biblical concept. Most Christian conservatives genuinely view President Bush as God's right-hand man in protecting the good in the world. They genuinely believe that. You see, ordinarily, diplomats do not use the phrase good versus evil when analyzing international political affairs. They rather use concepts such as balance of powers or control of strategic natural resources. These are the concepts that they use, not things like good and evil. Because, as they argue, good and evil is a very loaded and vague phrase. It means different things to different people. Many Christian conservatives, particularly Christian fundamentalists, genuinely analyze the current events in Iraq as a biblical development. Even some in the Bush administration have this belief. They believe that what is transpiring in Iraq today is related to the second coming of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, and the concept of Armageddon. For them, Saddam Hussein symbolized Antichrist. For them, Iraqi oil or geopolitical considerations do not even factor into this equation. I don't believe, personally, that people in the Pentagon or the State Department view the developing situation in Iraq as related to the second coming of Jesus Christ, but nonetheless, this is the perception that Christian fundamentalists have, and that's how they vote. The bottom line is this, that religion is quite pervasive in modern social and political life. Religious perceptions and ideas play a very significant role in shaping world events. Now, this is definitely unexpected according to social sciences. The fact that religion would play a significant role influencing global events is definitely something new to social scientists. You see, it caught especially secular thinkers off guard. I don't think any of them anticipated the Iranian Revolution of 1979 or the rise of Christian fundamentalism in U.S. politics. No secular thinker in the 50s and 60s even imagined that such a possibility would even come to pass. In the 50s and 60s, most secularists tended to assume that religion was a primitive superstition outgrown by civilized and rational men. So they confidently predicted the imminent demise of religion. To them, at best, religion was a marginal and a private matter. That's the best position they could even imagine for religion in society. To them, religion could no longer influence world events, and I guess we can all say that it was false prophecy. The fact that we are witnessing a resurgence of religion despite the Renaissance, despite the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment era in Europe, shows that religion is an important human need. It cannot be easily discarded or pushed to the sidelines, no matter how rational or how sophisticated our society becomes. In my opinion, religion forever will be an important enterprise in human affairs. Yes, there are times that it will go into remission, so to speak, but it will eventually come back with a greater force. The important question that we need to address is this: is religion society's downfall or salvation? Which one is it? Does religion contribute to social well-being, or is it an impediment to social progress? If we consider historical records, I guess we would conclude that the social performance of religion is mixed. There are periods in which religion serves as a positive force, bringing diverse people together in times of crisis to overcome division and despair, to fight oppression, injustice, discrimination, and prejudice. Yet, there are other times that religion actually becomes an impediment to social unity and social progress. In all fairness, I believe that, with no exception, all world religions initially emerged as a challenge to oppression, injustice, tyranny, and prejudice. There is no exception to this rule. If you study the history of all world religions, invariably you will come across this theme. All religions initially, at the time of their prophets, emphasized compassion towards the weak and the needy as the most important virtue. To them, compassion is what would get men and women closer to God. Initially, all religions embraced the golden rule in ethics. What is the golden rule? Do unto others as you would want others to do unto you. Again, this is a recurring theme in the history of religion. As a result, all world religions at the time of their inception made their societies more tolerant and more ethical. On the flip side, as I mentioned, there are periods when these same religions that initially united people, they would, in later generations, pit people against each other. It would divide communities. They would make people extremely intolerant and, yes, extremely cruel. I believe that the cruelty in the history of world religions is unmistakable and it is undeniable. There is a lot of cruelty committed by religious folks all over the world. It's not specific to a given religion. The Christian history, for example, is marred with the Crusades, Inquisitions, persecutions, and forced conversion of people into Christianity, all in the name of Christ. See, this is the amazing thing, that all this cruelty was committed in the name of Jesus Christ, who was a man of mercy and compassion for all creation. Muslims have had their share of cruelty in history. In modern day, we can witness the cruelty of Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan, the cruelty of Al-Qaeda, its crimes against humanity in the US, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, all over the world. We can definitely find brutality committed by Muslims in Iran, in Iraq, in the Sudan, Darfur, so on and so forth. Again, all done supposedly to please God. The same goes for Jews, Hindus, and other religious communities. They also have their share of ugliness and their contribution to cruelty in human history. Again, I want to reiterate that religion has the potential for both building bridges amongst human communities as well as the potential to burn bridges. It can be both a force for unity as well as division. Both potentials exist in world religion. You see, both Islam and Christianity have had an astonishing achievement. What is that achievement? Bringing such diverse cross-section of humanity under one roof. It is absolutely astonishing that a religion would have that kind of a capability. Different genders, races, cultures, ethnicity, economic classes, literacy rates, political tendencies, people of all different stripes coming under the same roof, believing in the same principles, praising the same God and the same ideal. This is really nothing short of a miracle. Islam, Christianity, to some extent Judaism, and also Buddhism have achieved unparalleled success in history in that regard. No secular philosophy has ever managed to create unity out of such diversity. Just consider, for example, Marxism, one of the most advanced social philosophy that humankind has created. Yes, it did manage to unite much of humanity, but it was mostly credited to force. It wasn't a matter of the heart. That's why that empire of unity just simply withered away. It didn't last for more than 70 years. Whereas we find Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam uniting humanity to this day under the same umbrella for thousands of years. Yet, these very same religions that have the potential to unite communities across the globe, they can also make people in the same neighborhood to be at each other's throat. This is the bewildering paradox that we find in the history of religion. Let me give you an example. Last December coincided with the annual pilgrimage of Muslims that they call Hajj. That's the time of the year that Muslims visit the sacred shrine in Mecca. Last December, we all witnessed how African blacks in Mecca sat down side by side white Europeans. How Farsi-speaking folks performed exactly the same rituals as Chinese folks. They all lived side by side in peace and harmony for weeks. At that same period in Iraq, we witnessed Arab-speaking Muslims from the same neighborhood in Baghdad slaughtering each other brutally, just because one is a Shi'i Muslim, the other one a Sunni Muslim. That just shows you how both of these paradoxical phenomena can exist side by side at the same time. Both potentials exist in reality. We must admit that the religious instinct is very powerful in humanity, and it can be used for good and ill. So, just as we have bad cooking, and just as we have bad art, we also have bad religion. Not all cooking is good, not all art is good, and with the same token, not all religion is good. Definitely, we have a lot of bad religion out there that should be confronted, because that stripe of religiosity is really detrimental to human spiritual and material progress. Now, I want to address the core of this part of the lecture, how religion can be both a source of peace as well as friction in society. You see, I really believe that religion has an amazing potential to amplify. The potential to amplify. In other words, religion will make good people better and bad people worse. That is the amazing potential of religion. That's what I mean by amplification. Let's consider a couple of verses from the Quran just to illuminate this point. Religion really does not, quote-unquote, make people better or worse. It just brings out what is inside people. Chapter 9, verse 124. When a chapter of the Quran is revealed, some hypocrites say, "Have any of you been strengthened in faith by this?" It certainly does strengthen the faith of those who believe, and they rejoice. But as for the perverse at heart, each new chapter adds further to their uncleanliness. They die disbelieving. In other words, the same chapter of a holy book, once it is revealed, it can make some people to turn towards God, to have faith, to have compassion. The others, it only advances the uncleanliness of their heart. That is absolutely astonishing. Let me give you another example from the Quran. This example actually makes reference to plants, ants, bees, cows, so on and so forth, as signs of God. Everything that exists in the universe, every molecule, atom, every phenomenon is considered to be a sign of God. Apparently, the disbelievers at the time of Revelation found it inappropriate for God, the symbol of majesty, to use such benign creatures to represent Him. They thought that ants and bees were not worthy enough to be mentioned as the signs of God. I just gave you a context for the verse that I'm about to recite for you. Now here is the verse, chapter 2, verse 26. Through these revealed verses, God makes many go astray and leads many to the right path, but he makes only the rebels go astray. In other words, the same verses, once revealed, it makes some folks go astray and others to be led on the right path towards salvation. In other words, because of all holy books we have out there, the Quran, the Bible, the Jewish scripture, you know, the Hindu sacred scripture, doesn't matter. Because of those sacred books, some people are guided to light, others are guided to darkness. The impact of these sacred books is not the same on everybody. Its impact depends on the person's inner state. It depends on the cleanliness of the heart of the person who receives it. It depends on the nobility of the intentions of those people. Rumi, the great Iranian Muslim mystic, perhaps said it the best in a nice poem. I'm going to read you the poem in Farsi and then attempt to translate it into English. زان که از قرآن بسی گمره شدند زان رسن قومی درون چه شدند مر رسن را نیست جرمی ای انود چون تو را سودای سربالا نبود. It can't be said any more beautifully than that. Rumi says that religion is like a rope. Its function is to assist in climbing. You can use a rope either to climb out of a well or descend into it. The rope does not set the direction, you do. That's exactly how Rumi perceived religion to be. If you have noble intentions, if you have a good heart, you will use the religious teachings in order to do good things in this world. If you have evil intentions and a bad heart, you will use the same religious principles to commit atrocity and cruelty in this world. So, here is my 2 cents on this issue. Religion tends to intensify the yearning, the craving, and the inner desire of religious folks. It gives momentum to their motives and their aspirations. The real question, however, is this: how can we harness the powers of religion to be in the service of good rather than evil? See, that's the $1 million question. How can we do that? We cannot live without religion. It's part of us. It is built into our structure. Nonetheless, once we turn to religion, some of us commit cruelty. How can we avert that? In my opinion, there are pitfalls in religiosity. In other words, there are sources of danger in religious life that are unfortunately hidden and not so apparent or obvious. Just because they are hidden, we don't pay enough attention to them. That's why we become victims a lot of times when we turn to religion. These pitfalls can produce the opposite effect from what the founders of the great world religions initially intended. Some of these pitfalls can make religious folks very susceptible to fall prey to greedy politicians or corrupt clergymen who are eager to take advantage of their yearning for God and salvation. Other pitfalls can make religious folks serve evil rather than good, all in the name of God and faith. That is when religion becomes a reactionary force in human affairs, and it becomes socially divisive. Hopefully, once we know what these pitfalls are, we can take appropriate measures to avoid them. Now, I'm going to give you three or four pitfalls that, in my opinion, are the most important to be aware of. You will notice that there is a common thread running through all of them. One way or the other, they are divisive. They divide humanity into warring camps, especially if they are taken to the extreme. Let's go over them as much as we have time tonight. The first really important pitfall in religiosity is when religion becomes a badge of honor to wear. It's a pitfall we rarely pay attention to, when religion becomes our identity. A lot of time, actually, religion is promoted that way. We want to become identified with a community. I'm here to tell you that if this tendency is exaggerated, it will lead to catastrophe. Let me explain in some detail. You see, having a sense of identity is very crucial for our psychological development. Having a sense of identity actually gives us a sense of self, who we are. It gives us direction and purpose in life. It's amazing that one of the phrases used to refer to the contemporary generation is Generation X. You know what that means, right? A generation that cannot define its identity. It's a bad thing when you have no identity whatsoever, because lack of identity will ultimately lead to confusion and despair, both at the individual level as well as the societal level. So some measures of identity is very important and crucial to have. Now, as you know, too much of a good thing can sometimes be very bad for you. Identity is just such a thing. Too much of it, very strong identity, actually can be very detrimental. If we exaggerate about our identity, if we really blow our uniqueness out of proportion, that will lead to a false sense of distinction. That's when we find ourselves to be distinct, separate, and apart from others who are not like us. That's the divisive aspect of a strong religious identity. Unfortunately, religion can create such an exaggerated identity for its followers. Why? Because every religion invariably will have special prayers, special commandments, special rituals. Every religion will have special congregations, a unique sacred book. Because of this exclusivity and uniqueness, this pitfall exists in all world religions. Now, when religion becomes predominantly an expression of identity, it will separate us, the believers, from them, the unbelievers. If that happens, religion will no longer will be a vehicle to get at truth. It is no longer a vehicle for us to come into contact with God. It will no longer be about truth or faith. Religion will be exclusively a sign of distinction. Now, if religion is reduced to identity, suddenly God will be viewed as the personal property of a group. Let me repeat what I just said. If truly religion becomes our identity, we will view God as our personal property, as if God only belongs to us. Now, if this perception takes hold in the psyche of a religious community, then they will defend their religion or their identity the way they defend their home and their property. See, that's exactly how some people tend to protect their religion and their identity, as if they are protecting their property. Philosophers and scientists use a completely different mechanism for defending the truth. Why? Because truth is not possession. The truth is not the personal property of anybody. Truth really is like a free spirit that floats around. When it touches somebody, it will awaken him or her. It will give the person a clear vision. It will set the person free from ignorance and darkness, and then it will move on. Truth, be it theological or scientific, requires a suitable means for its acquisition, its defense, and its propagation. But when religion becomes a form of identity, it will use fist for its defense rather than reason. You see, scientists and philosophers, they always use reason and rational argumentation to prove their point and, as they see it, defend the truth. Religious folks who view religion primarily as identity, they defend their perception of truth with fist and not reason. However, religion was never meant by world prophets to be a badge of honor to be worn in public. No prophet would ever view religion like that. In their own unique ways, all world prophets invited humanity to take on the color of God. They all invited humanity to take on a divine identity. They challenged humanity to transcend the man-made signs of distinction, such as race, gender, social class, nationality. See, these are all man-made signs of distinction. All prophets of the world, absolutely with no exception, they invited us to view these signs of distinction as false sources of distinction. They all wanted us to identify with God, to make Him as the only object of our admiration and praise, not our social class, not our gender, not our race, or our nationality or ethnicity. They truly wanted us not to treat our sacred book or theological doctrine or places of worship as signs of our identity. You see, a lot of us identify with a place of worship. We identify ourselves with a sacred book or certain theological dogma. That was not, in my opinion, the original intention of world prophets. This is the first pitfall that we need to avoid. The second pitfall in religiosity is what is known as exclusivism. Exclusivism. What do I mean by that? You see, some folks in every religious community believe that guidance has only befallen them. Somehow, they are the only ones who have stumbled across the truth. Just somehow, they are the only ones who have been saved. Everyone else is doomed and damned. It is as if their religion offers the only valid and acceptable path to God. They think that God is partial to certain theological doctrines. Their perception is that God only cares about them. God is only happy with them. God is only compassionate with them and uncompassionate with everybody else. This is what we call exclusivism in theology. In their mind, the circle of salvation is so small that only they fit in it. Now, it is good to feel that we are saved. It's a good feeling to have, right? But it is awful to think that everyone else is going to burn in hell just because they do not utter the same words about God that we do, or because they articulate their beliefs about God in a different set of theological doctrine. When one perceives his path as the only valid path toward God, is very divisive. This mentality definitely can divide humanity along theological doctrines. This mentality definitely will feed the us versus them paradigm. Now, having said that, let me also make a statement here. No prophet ever defined salvation as holding certain beliefs or performing certain rituals or prayers. If you go back to the point of the origin of these religions, salvation was never defined as being synonymous with certain beliefs or certain rituals or practices. This kind of formulation, by the way, equating salvation with theories about God or certain rituals, is a later development in the history of all world religions. You see, one is saved when she lets go of her ego. See, that, in my opinion, is the definition of salvation. If you are successful in letting go of your ego, you are saved. One can either serve God or his or her own ego. All world prophets, in their own unique way, shared this wisdom with us, that salvation in some sense requires a loss of ego. This wisdom is beautifully captured in the Holy Quran, chapter 16, verse 36. God says, "We sent a messenger to every community to say, worship God and shun the arrogant. Worship God and shun the arrogant." This is the common denominator of all world religions. It is an invitation to humanity to submit to God and not to the arrogant. You see, the arrogant has a big and uncontrollable ego. These world prophets, according to the Quran, basically pointed out that it is the ego that holds us back from God. You see, a lot of us incorrectly think that it is the inaccurate theological doctrines that will separate us from God, or inaccurate religious rituals or practices that will make us separate from God, when in fact it is the ego that really separates us from the divine or God. Egotism has many expressions. See, that's the big deal. Egotism has a lot of different expressions. Greed is one of them. Hatred, intolerance, bitterness, envy, jealousy, revenge, wickedness, trickery, deceit. These are all examples or expressions of egotism. All of these vices tend to serve exactly the same function, separating us from God. You see, the more of these vices that show up in our character, the further apart we will be from God. So that is the wisdom that this Quranic verse is sharing with us, that we can equally find in all sacred books. Starvation is a state of existence where we are free from these vices. Every single religion out there offers certain practices to its followers to overcome egotism, to deny the ego from its vital sources of nourishment. In my opinion, at the end of the hour, all religious chores and practices must serve us to deny the ego from its vital sources of nourishment. That's what we are supposed to be doing. Therefore, whoever has successfully shrunk her ego and managed to rid her character from these vices is saved, regardless of the manner in which she praises God or the specific religious services she attends. She is saved if she is successful in that regard. Salvation should not be measured by the volume of our prayers, the volume of our church attendance, or the weight of the cross that we carry on our chest. That is not how salvation should be measured. Rather, it should be measured by our detachment from vices and attainment of a sense of inner peace, serenity, and loving kindness. That is what salvation is all about. So that was the second pitfall then, exclusivism. The way to avoid that pitfall is to correct our understanding of what salvation is all about, which is to shrink our ego. Now, the third pitfall that we need to be mindful of: reducing faith to dogma. You see, in the history of religion, we constantly come across the same theme. World prophets were interested in human behavior, not dogma. Let me repeat. All world prophets were interested in human behavior, not dogma. Their focus was on enabling men and women to meet God through behavioral modification. You want to meet God? You need to change your behavior. All world prophets taught us faith. In later generations, their teachings would be transformed into a belief system. I don't want to lose you, so let me repeat. World prophets taught us faith. In later generations, that teaching was transformed into a belief system, or what we call dogma. This unintended transformation often gives a false impression that the prophet's ultimate goal and mission was to teach the correct theology. Faith in God is not an abstract metaphysical belief. Rather, faith is an openness to God. To cultivate an attitude of trust in God. What do I mean by trust? Well, exactly the same way when we say we have faith in an ideal or a person, right? Because we believe that that person will carry through with his promises. When you have trust in God, in some sense, you believe that God will make good on his promises, even though sometimes those promises may seem absurd to some. World prophets were more concerned with teaching methods of behavioral modification, to teach us methods to modify our behavior, to change one's self on the image of God, and then later change society accordingly. right? They invited us to change our behavior on the image of God, and then next move on changing society accordingly. As Buddha said, after enlightenment, one should return to the marketplace and practice compassion towards all living things. Again, you find this wisdom in the Holy Bible, in the Holy Quran, in the Holy Jewish Scripture, so on and so forth. The articulation of the wisdom may be different, but the point is exactly the same. But despite the centerpiece of the Prophet's mission, which is an invitation to turn to God, to have faith and trust in God, in later generations, as I mentioned, dogma takes over and becomes the centerpiece of religiosity. Then people are asked to submit to dogma. You see, submitting to God is not the same thing as submitting to dogma, right? Slowly but surely, doctrinal correctness becomes the focal point in religion. Dogmatism is an exaggerated form of putting dogma ahead of faith. Dogmatism is rooted in a view of religion which is very conducive for people to fight over dogma or correct theology rather than correct behavior. What theologians do invariably in the history of religion is to place God the infinite into a box that is the size of their own imagination. See, that's what happens invariably in all world religions. Some theologians arrive on the scene and they attempt to put God the infinite in a box that is the same size as their own imagination. Yes, it is true that God the infinite does not reveal himself to men and women in his infinity. You see, infinity is incomprehensible to us. We need to put walls around anything in order for us to be able to comprehend it. God is no exception. Yes, even though God reveals himself according to man's capacity, that revelation is not according to God's capacity. God reveals himself to every single one of us according to our capacity, not his capacity. Again, Rumi probably said it the best. دم که مرد نایی اندر نای کرد در خور نای است نه در خور مرد. Rumi says, when you give a flute to a skillful musician, the tune that comes out of the flute suits the flute and not the musician's ability. If you give the musician a better flute, he will create better music for you. It's as if every single one of us is a flute on the lips of God. See, he blows in us. Once he blows in us, we come to sound, we talk. That's exactly what happens when we start articulating our feelings and our experiences of the divine. Yet we should always be mindful that what goes into the flute is not the same thing as what comes out. Let me talk about an unfortunate fact in the history of world religion. The God that men and women create in a particular religion should not be confused with God himself. We should never confuse God with man-made theories about God, which we call dogma. Some folks incorrectly worship theories about God, which is another form of idolatry. Prophets and philosophers have correctly warned us in history against crafting God after our own image. You see, religion becomes a liability when God becomes an idol crafted and carved in our own image. Every time that happens, religion becomes a liability. It's no longer an asset in the service of human intellectual, spiritual, and material progress. When God becomes a projection of our limited needs, fears, and desires, then religion will become a liability. Instead of putting us beyond our limitations, then God can encourage us to remain complacently within our own limitations. Instead of making God a symbol to challenge our prejudice and force us to contemplate our shortcomings, God can be made via theology to endorse our egotistic hatred of others. Again, that is the job of theology and dogma. It is not the teaching of world prophets. This kind of bad theology makes God behave exactly like us. It is as if God is just a superman, as Nietzsche used to say. If that happens, if we carve God on our own image, then we will assume that He loves what we love. He hates what we hate. He endorses our prejudices instead of compelling us to transcend our prejudices. So, let me make a brotherly advice to all of you. Don't ever say God is on our side. You see, this is the phrase that politicians love to repeat all the time. God is on our side. Rather, we should always try to evaluate our performance to ensure we are on His side. These two are not the same thing. We should ensure that our actions measure up to divine expectations. That is our job. So that's the third pitfall that we find in all world religions. In other words, confusing faith with dogma and how it can contribute to divisiveness in human community. You see, once we emphasize dogma as the sign of religiosity, no two religious communities will share the same theological doctrines. So those doctrines will serve to separate us and give impetus to the us versus them mentality. That's when religion will tend to create tension and conflict in human societies. The fourth and the last pitfall that I want to talk about, because we're running out of time. Ideology of election. What does that mean? When a community believes that they have a destiny, a divine destiny to lead humanity, that's what we call ideology of election. Now, this ideology of election comes in many colors, many brands and stripes. We find it both in secular as well as religious circles. All communities at some point seem to foster these kind of ideologies. For example, nationalist leaders sometimes portray themselves as the historical destiny of a nation to free them. Right? Somebody like Napoleon is just a good example. He really thought that he was destined by history to lead the French nation towards salvation. He was there to save the French nation. Let me give you another example, manifest destiny. For those of you who are not familiar with it, let me give you a 1 minute introduction to this ideology of election. Manifest destiny was a phrase that was coined probably by a journalist called John O'Sullivan in 1845. Manifest Destiny expressed the belief that the U.S. had a divinely inspired mission to expand, spreading its democracy, its freedom, its values and ideals. Its advocates believed that expansion was not only good, but it was obvious, manifest, and it was inevitable destiny. You see, that's where the phrase comes into play, manifest destiny. It is inevitable and it is obvious, right? According to them. Even though the idea initially was created and related to the westward migration of settlers in the 1800s, it has mutated in many forms in later periods. Today, some folks in this country also promote the Manifest Destiny doctrine. What do they mean by that? It is the historical destiny of the U.S. to craft the world on its ideals, values, and image. Again, this is another example of the ideology of election. In religious circles, ideology of election means a community is chosen by God to represent Him in some form of fashion. Let me repeat. When a community believes that it is chosen by God to represent Him on earth. Unfortunately, every community at some point and sometimes has a flattering view of itself. However, if this view is exaggerated and blown out of proportion to a level that is tantamount to being elected by a higher power to control the world, it can become a very dangerous illusion. It's a very dangerous illusion for a community to think that it was chosen by God to control the world. It can serve to justify naked aggression against others. In fact, history is marred by holy wars that originated from such ideologies of election. See, no holy war can ever be fought in a vacuum. Without such ideologies of election, you can never have holy wars. However, this mindset needs to be corrected. So that was the pitfall. Let me tell you my two cents about the remedy to this pitfall. Again, we need to adjust our thinking and correct our viewpoint on this subject. You see, God is not partial towards any particular race, ethnicity, gender, or nationality. The Quran, perhaps, provides a good illumination and a good depiction of God's preference. What does God prefer? Does God prefer one gender over another, one nation over another, or one ethnicity or culture over another? The answer is absolutely no. This is a very famous verse in the Quran. The intended audience of this verse is all humanity. Chapter 49, verse 13. O people, we created you all from a single man and a single woman, and we made you nations and tribes so that you should get to know each other, not to fight each other, but to know each other, to learn from each other. In God's eyes, the most honored of you are the ones most pious. God is all-knowing, all-aware. In the eyes of God, the best of us is the most pious. Again, this wisdom you can find in Christianity, in Judaism, in Buddhism, Hinduism, and all world religion in some form or fashion. Again, the articulation may be different, but the idea is exactly the same. piety has nothing to do with the knowledge we hold about God in our head. Piety has nothing to do with our color of skin, our gender, or even our religious affiliation. Piety has to do with the content of our character. That's what piety is all about. Those who practice compassion and bring warmth and comfort to others are definitely closer to God, regardless of how they articulate their theological doctrines. If you practice more compassion in this world, you are closer to God. If you serve humanity more, you are definitely closer to God. It doesn't matter what words you utter about God, how you do your religious chores and prayers and practices. That is secondary to religion. Now, one may feel that he or she is chosen by God to serve others, or is chosen by God to spread the good word. There is nothing wrong with having this good feeling, right? It is okay as long as we understand this election is not binding on others. Let me repeat. It is okay to have this good feeling that we are saved, that we are chosen by God to serve others, right? As long as we understand this election is not binding on others. It is purely between us and God. It doesn't afford any of us any special social privileges or rights in society. Just because I feel or I think I have received a calling by God doesn't mean that I have some privileges that others don't have. If I truly have received a calling from God, I better start living it, not beating on my chest, saying that I'm better than everybody else. I should start practicing it. So that was the fourth pitfall in religiosity, ideology of election. No such ideology has ever come to us from God. Nobody by birth or by virtue of being born into a religious community is closer to God. You see, God is equidistant to every single one of us. What gets us closer to God is the loss of ego, opening us to God, and practicing compassion in the world. And here are my concluding remarks. Let me summarize. Religion is neither a superstition nor opium of the masses. If it were, it would have been discarded long ago. Religion is an integral part of human existence. It is part of the structure of humanity, as if we are all pre-wired for it. At its core, religion espouses spirituality and ethical behavior. However, religious life is not without peril or pitfalls. Tonight we reviewed four of the major pitfalls that we can find in all world religions. Hopefully, once we know what they are, we can take measures to avoid them. These pitfalls make religious folks more vulnerable to becoming prey for greedy politicians and power hungry. You see, power always prefers those who aid its ambitions. Power always prefers that reading of religion that aids its ambition. That's why anytime religion is taken up by folks who have power, it always spells disaster for humanity, because the powerful will ultimately adopt a reading of religion that serves their own interest. Sometimes these pitfalls can also make us more divided, and it can lead us into warring camps, contributing to conflict and tension. Religious preachers will aid warmongers if they promote the divisive mentality of us versus them. Anything that promotes this kind of mentality definitely is a liability for the humankind. You see, it is impossible to wage war before you instill this mentality in people's head and mind. Only when the lines of demarcation between us and others are very clear and they are very bold, we will never ever engage in warfare against others. So, we need to recognize the inherent diversity in human cultural legacy. This diversity is not artificial. The fact that we are diverse in terms of religion, culture, ethnicity, so on and so forth, it is not artificial. It is real. We need to respect it. This diversity grows out of the varying experiences of life and historical backgrounds. However, we should not allow our religious and cultural diversity to degenerate into social animosity. That is bad. See, sometimes when we emphasize a lot the diversity in human cultural legacy, inadvertently that kind of thinking can lead to social animosity. Animosity, even when promoted in the name of God, is really a symbol of egotism. Animosity always grows out of egotism, even when it is promoted in the name of God and religion. Religion can and should be a voice for compassion, social justice, tolerance, and peaceful coexistence. These are virtues that are part and parcel to the teachings of all world religions and all world prophets. We just need to acknowledge that. We're running out of time. I'm going to stop right here, and inshallah, if I have another opportunity, I can expand on this theme some more in the future. Thank you very much for your attention. God bless you all. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.